Hi, folks. Barry and Ben here. We're doing an intro together for the first time in ages.
Hello. It's like the old days when we thought you needed to hear both of our voices at the start every single week, no matter what. Otherwise, as our poor little worst foot forward children, you would worry that Daddy and Daddy had forgotten about you.
Yeah, no, be rest assured, both your daddies still love you very much. Just both of your daddies have been variously very busy slash ill for the last basically 3 weeks.
Yeah, we absolutely have. That's ill with a small I, given
not a C. Yeah. Ben had the cold, then I had the cold. Now my husband has the cold.
And
For listeners not in the UK, there is, and maybe it's just in the entertainment industry as well, to be fair, but there is a big cold going around at the moment that it seems like everyone has been passing to each other, and it's like it's one of those that's taking a week or two to shift as well.
Yeah, it does feel like whatever this year's cold virus is taking a look at COVID and going, oh, how a virus are we? Hold my beer.
Yeah, I better up my game just to remind you all I'm an annual event.
Yeah, so I have been busy with, I've had, as I think I alluded to at the start of this week's episode, I'm in the belly of the late autumn, early Christmas gigging beast. I've been Northampton and Brighton and Oxfordshire, and tonight I'm off to Hampshire, and then I'm in Reading and Kent over the next week. So all over the shop.
You're here, there, and everywhere.
Barry is falling in and out of time as I fall in and out of space.
Yeah, I've got a slightly vaguely long-termish acting job in Doctor Who Time Fracture, which is an immersive Doctor Who show that is opened in London earlier in the year, had to close for various COVID reasons, and is now reopening on, it will have reopened by the time you hear this, on Friday the 26th of November, and it's running till currently till April. And if anyone is a fan of Doctor Who or just likes a rollicking good time, it's really, I was chatting to Ben about it earlier. It is a very cool show to be a part of. Like for Doctor Who fans, there is so much fan service and Easter eggs and things that they'll really enjoy. And, you know, it puts the audience right at the center of everything. You become the heroes in your own adventure because the Doctor can't save the world this time. They're busy, so they've called on you. If anyone's in London wants to come along, you can go to immersivedoctorwho.com and buy tickets. Come and see me. And
if you want to spot Barry, he is playing the Sonic Screwdriver.
I've just pulled the website up in front of me. The artwork and the costuming and everything is just badass. It's very cool. I've been rehearsing that quite hectically for the last wee while, and Ben's been gigging and we've both been ill. So we haven't, and various guests have also been ill and busy. So we haven't got a full episode for you this week. We have cobbled together some offcuts of best bits that didn't quite make the final cuts. Ben has lovingly crafted them into an oral delight for you all to enjoy. But before you listen to that, live show klaxon, guys. That'll have peaked on the audio.
Yeah, it really was. More so than that, I have never felt more like an American secondhand car salesman on cable TV in the 80s.
I thought you were going to say like an American second banana on talk radio.
Also that.
Yeah. We are returning to the Vault Festival in London, where we had our first live show nearly 2 years ago now. They are very, very kindly having us back on the 20th of February at 2:30. That's a Sunday, as it was last time round. We will be taking over one of their lovely spaces for a full hour, and we will be joined by a couple of fabulous guests for the World's Worst Games Night.
Yeah, and of course, because we're World's Foot Forward, we are doing a games night in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah, 100%.
And most crucially, we will, of course, talk to you about the artistic content of the show as it goes on. But this time round, we're going to be mercenary as all hell. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a 170-seater theatre, which is too big for this podcast.
It is literally twice the size of the room we were in for the festival 2 years ago.
But we are determined that we are going to fill it. And by giving you the 3-month heads up about the show, we think that we can. tickets are now available. If you live in London, you literally have no excuse, and I will twist your arm with that blackmail. If you live within 1 to 2 hours of London, hop on the train, make a day of it, see London's delightful South Bank, pop into the theatre to see us, and then see more of London's delightful South Bank before toddling off home.
Yeah, it's right underneath Waterloo Station at the Vault Festival. You could not have better transport links. And it's tickets are just £13. So, you know, you're going to get a full hour of Worsford Ford. You're going to get Ben and myself, and you're going to get some brilliant guests. I'm not going to lie. We're very excited.
Yeah, we have two guests confirmed who are absolutely, definitely superb. And one who we are just trying to slowly tease in that if we manage to land this remarkable carp, they can never know I've referred to them as a carp, but that's the fish I think about landing. If we do land it, it will be one of the best guests we've ever had on the show.
The guests that we have already lined up are returning guests. We have the brilliant Johnny Chiodini, who has been on the show twice already. They are, of course, the renowned DM for the Oxventurers Guild, the D&D series on YouTube, formerly of Eurogamer and Dicebreaker, all-round excellent board game and video game journalist, and Scummy Mummy podcast extraordinaire co-host Ellie Gibson, returning for the first time since episode 4. She was on episode 4 of this podcast. All of God, it's 4 or 5 years ago that we recorded that episode with her. And it's going to be so great because the Scummy Mummy's podcast has just absolutely rocketed even since then. So Ellie, also formerly of Eurogamer, so a video game, and Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit as well, video gamer herself, and she is going to be, it's going to be so lovely having them both on the show, and ideally, fingers crossed, our mega super third guest as well. So it'll be well worth the price of the ticket, which, as I said, is very affordable. You can go to vaultfestival.com right now, /events/ Worsford Forward live recording, or just go on the homepage and search for Worsford Forward, and you'll find us looking spiffing in our tuxedos.
Yes, you will. So we hope you enjoyed this week's Offcuts. If you really need an extra Worsford Forward fix, you can always go to patreon.com/Worsford Forward, sign up for as little as £2 a month, where you'll get all sorts of other extra Offcuts and games. And you'll be able to read chapter 1 of the book that we have sent out to various literary agents. And within about 10 days or so, you'll be able to read chapter 2 as well.
Eventually, we're self-publishing in a really roundabout way. All right. Enjoy this week's episode. And we'll see you hopefully with a guest next week.
How did how they did it? I think they did it by good clothes.
Yes. Yeah,
because for the longest time, if you can't govern, look impressive, you know, is
big mustaches and hats.
Hats, mustaches, yeah. Western clothes. Yeah. You know, I was impressed. You know, like
battle them with umbrellas.
Yeah, handlebar mustaches. English, the language. Yeah. You know, that's
well there is. I don't know if it exists anymore, but there is a gig in, I think, Soho Square, and it's something like the Army and Naval Club, and you go through the door, and it's like going into the 19th century. And I'm normally not that cowed by that sort of bullshit, because I went to a private school, and so I've whatever advantage in education they gave me, it means that I am not intimidated by the showiness of power and authority.
Regalia. Yeah.
Precisely the word, yeah. But even though I opened the door and I just got a look of the back entrance for the likes of you, I think, and was like, oh yes, terribly sorry.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing with India as well, though, is that we didn't send our brightest and best over to govern. As far as I understand it, generally, you know, the first son would look after the estate, and the second one would go into the clergy, and the third one might go into the military, but fight, you know, proper wars against European nations.
Near home, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And but it was the fourth of it. We were essentially sending the subs bench out to deal with India.
But also, it's a hard sell, right? I mean, you go to a young person who's coming out of Cambridge, be like, your choices are inherit the family business.
Great.
You know, in Shropshire.
Yeah.
Or we're sending you to a country where you may be eaten by a tiger or die of malaria in the in the first 6 minutes after the But if you survive to the 7th minute, you'll be an Earl.
You get a governorship.
But I love that, because British people, I think we do, not just to the extent of Germans, but we do like to set order and rules on things. And the impression I get of the empire in India is this country full of mad wildlife and exotic diseases and balmy weather. And the British people could go over there, and it's just, if we just focus hard enough, we can make the weather and the wildlife obey our rules. If I stare at a tiger long enough, I can turn it into a hedgehog.
And then like a magic eye picture.
Yeah. That's what I think. I think just the British wanted to impose some system of order. Yeah. So if you've got wild man-eating tigers, can they form a queue? That was their only request.
Do you think the British looked at the globe in the 1800s and just went, it's all too disparate. If we could just like shove all the countries together into one big circular country, that would just make it everything much neater.
Yeah, I think that was someone at Whitehall. Sat down and said, well, we run these places. Yeah.
Condense the world into one easy to manage continent.
There's a story, we might have spoken about it before, and I think it's in the Middle East rather than in Asia, but the story of Churchill's knuckles.
Oh no.
So when the Middle East was being carved up, I think it was carved up between World War One and World War Two. Churchill stuck a ruler down, drew a line on it, it went over his knuckles, and he went, yeah, that'll do. Anyway, lunch. And off
the
plate. And that is why there are so many tribal conflicts in those parts of the world, because we just carved it up willy-nilly. Well,
as opposed to America, where surprisingly straight natural land borders in a lot of those states.
Yeah,
this has always been Ohio. Yeah. It's from when? 1412. You weren't here in 1412. Yeah. But India-Pakistan, for example, you know, Cyril Radcliffe, who drew that border, had arrived in India. He'd never been to India. He arrived, he was seasick for most of his journey. It took a while to get to India. He arrived and he was told, you have one night to draw this map. And he was given the wrong map. And he imagined that night for him. He just sat there with a pencil and he was like, oh, fuck, Punjab, it's fine. And he just approved it.
We've all written an essay in a night for university
at some point. Yeah,
exactly.
But that's rushing your geography coursework, which will have an effect on the real world.
A great track record on partition in Britain with India and Palestine and Cyprus and Ireland. Flawless every single time.
Good cartography.
Yeah.
They did well in theory because it was beautifully drawn.
Yeah.
Now, he had no idea it would lead to millions of people wanting to kill each other.
That's why so many maps have shit like sea monsters and unicorns on them. It's to distract you from the awful borders that we've drawn. The other weird thing with us, there's a great exhibition at the, I think it's the Royal Academy, all about the art and culture of Oceania. Is that how you say it?
Oceania, yeah.
Yeah. And there's an enormous art installation at the end, like a projection of the wall that's about 100 foot long.
Cool.
And it's a live video version of a piece of embroidery showing the interaction between the native islanders of Polynesia and these British guys turning up in white wigs and red suits and getting out their astrolabes and their telescopes. And if you watch it for long enough, the British look as patently ridiculous as these guys wandering around in grass skirts do to our Western eyes. And I think the difference is with the British Empire is the British were the first empire that turned up and took an interest.
Stayed,
but it's like when there's like the Royal Variety performance and Prince Philip goes, and what do you do?
Yeah.
And people are like, why do you care? You live in a giant opulent palace and in Windsor. It was the same, I imagine, you know, we'd be wandering around Darjeeling and going, what do you do? Yeah. No one's ever asked me
nobody
that before.
Nobody. Think if there was a Nicholas III, because I've been fascinated by this last one, he'd be, if you inherit a thing, like you were the great-grand-nephew, whatever, your family got killed 100 years ago, and you're told, right, we're bringing it back. You know, like if the Dalai Lama went away, and you just went to a kid 100 years later in Bhutan and said, you're the one. You know, it's initial years, you're a bit rusty.
Yeah.
You know, because till then, you were just a guy at Burger King or whatever. And now you just have the burden of the Romanovs, you know? Unless, you know, there are many kings who lose everything, property, etc. But their lineage still pretends like they have money.
Yes.
You know, I love that. You know, when you're in a one-bedroom,
like they're living in a hotel in Grosvenor Square or something.
Yeah, correct. And you can't afford it and the and you still have a liveried thing.
Yeah, I had a friend I went to university with. He was from Somerset and his dad was proper aristocracy and his mum was like a peasant girl, essentially. And he was something like 256th in line to the throne. And they were really rich until World War II, when the American GIs took over the family home. And when they all left, they basically looted the family home and lost all of their money. But he had this look of authority that he would give you, and you're like, wow, that is 800 years of aristocracy looking at me down your aquiline nose. And I'm like, I will obey whatever you say, James. Because, yeah, he's, like you say, it's in his blood, and he's got the, you know, he's got heraldry in there.
Yeah, even though he's eating a lamb shawarma and going to bed
in
a one-bedroom in Willesden, it's fine. But he's still, you know, it's intimidating. Because we don't know his financial situation. It's just the way he's... And you've got, like, at least, you know, where I'm from, you've got, like, bankrupt monarchy everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, just... You know, I knew a guy whose grandfather was a king, and his house is now an ICICI mortgage bank. And they just live off the rent. But he's got the air of a king.
Yeah, this I mean, I'm like Barry, I loathe monarchy apart from the things that they built.
Yeah.
Whenever I go around, I mean, is there an Indian equivalent of the National Trust? Or English Heritage?
We do. They're called British Tourists.
Right.
I just found out the charge to go to the Taj Mahal, if you're a foreigner, is £50.
Uh-huh.
And for a local, it's ₹5. So, you know, it's what I like is there's no discrimination at all.
Great, yeah.
It's £50 versus 2p. So we maintain it by basically loads of Europeans coming and saying, oh, this is really nice.
Seems vaguely appropriate somehow.
Yeah, there's someone saying it's a reverse of history and that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Plundering the British to pay for the upkeep.
Right. In reverse. But here you guys keep the buildings. And what would we have to see in any country if it wasn't, you know?
Yeah, whenever I go around them, we visited me and my wife. I can't remember what it was called, but it's a beautiful place in... Oh, Christ, where was it? I don't know. Let's say somewhere like Buckinghamshire. And I was like, this is stunning, beautiful gardens, gorgeous house. Would have hated the person who lived here.
Yeah.
But, like, they would not have approved of you know, a Jewish guy and a half-Italian Scot wandering around the grounds. You'd have wanted to get the elephant gun and chase us off there. I feel really bad looking back at history about the amount of money that was pooled in individuals so they could build these houses... But I like the houses, even though they meant that the people living nearby would probably have starved.
Yeah.
I get very conflicted looking at history.
Yeah.
My biggest issue with kings in history is the way modern historians talk about them. Where they go, so Suleiman the Magnificent, when he came to the throne, he garrotted his five brothers at half-brothers and murdered their harem of wives, and he ruled with the fire and the sword and put heads on the executioner's block, but... Great administrator.
Yeah. It's a balance.
He's still a great prince of the 1500s.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the Chinese, for example, are now building cities to look like European cities.
Oh, it's so weird.
So they have a suburb of Beijing that looks exactly like Paris. And the public are given a choice. Either you leave with this compensation we've decided for you,
or we kill you.
In prison. And I think that's a fair choice.
And everyone in prison goes... beret, baguette, ooh la la.
Do you think
bienvenue at China?
Yeah. Do you think that China heard about the fact that we have Chinatowns over here and they've just got the wrong end of the stick?
This we can do this.
Yeah.
Why is there Champs-Élysées in the middle of Guangdong?
What would be brilliant if China sort of sets up all these little cities and then, like, the German bit starts to invade the French bit and the Polish bit?
Or they have the Tour de France has to end in the Champs-Élysées. Not that one.
That is got nothing to do with the podcast. That does. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst.
Do that again.
Get out. I was in it. I'd flow.
It's the first time you've ever gotten past the fourth word.
Yeah, it really is. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to First Foot. Oh, fuck everything.
Every time.
At least I haven't said nice to meet you for a while.
Yeah, it's true.
Hello.
It's in your head now, isn't it?
It is in my head. Hello, you massive fuck.
I think this is how you should start every podcast.
It does it fit with worst foot forward. It has been, yeah. We might. There'll be one where we do an actual terrible introduction. Right, put your cup of tea down. Deep breaths in through the ears, out through the arse. Here we go. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that opens up the door, pops its head on the... not its head on the hat stand, wanker.
He's usually not this bad, I'll give him
no,
that.
He's not. We're here to celebrate the grizzles, grumps and ghoulish side of life and celebrate the broken... I'm going to start that again. We're here to celebrate the grizzled, grumpy and ghoulish side of life, containing the broken, failing and sometimes the downright unsanitary. Each week, me, my co-host and our guest will uncover an example of some of the world's worst subjects and turn them over to the...
That's a lot of words.
What happened? You haven't spoken for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
you wouldn't think that I'm actually a professional voiceover monkey as well. There we are.
Each week, me, my co-host and our guest will uncover an example of some of the world's worst subjects.
You said that already.
Fuck you. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward.
All right. We are recording, Ben, whenever you are ready.
Hello, ladies and always got to have a quick dry run. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward. I am one half of your hosts, Ben Vanderveld. This is the pod... Now that's all dog shit.
This, like, literally every show Ben has an existential crisis.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week... Oh, that's also rubbish. I hate doing...
Just believe in yourself.
Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself.
Do you believe in fairies?
Thanks, pal. I mean, to be honest, you're normally getting double figures for this shit. Hello. No, too low.
Do you want me to do this?
No, I'm going to do it. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward.
Rosemary's magic trick, make your listeners disappear. I'm sorry, go on. You said those first five words beautifully.
I really did. I had momentum going for this.
I felt like it was it.
It felt like it
now
was...
it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Right, all right. 4 days later.
Let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens this time. Hello, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and that's not how I introduced it. I forgot how
just
I
fucking
this.
Do it! Just say anything! Just say... then come straight to me, and
no.
I'll take the heat off you.
Fuck you, I've got shit to do. I've got shit to say.
To be fair to Ben, he's not the only one who occasionally fucks up.
Our guest this week has been described as the Scotsman, as like a very tall, funny, excited child.
He's been described as the Scotsman?
He's been described by the Scotsman.
Oh, sorry.
By one Scotsman, as a very tall, funny, excited child. Somewhere between reincarnated Viking and gamekeeper on a country estate, and having performed stand-up for nearly a decade, he is also senior archaeologist at Museum of London Archaeology. Or has been promoted since I wrote this intro about 5 months ago. Go on, what are you called instead?
I am a project officer now.
Cool.
Sounds less cool than a senior archaeologist.
Yeah, but I do a hell of a lot more things.
Okay.
I office projects.
Project offices.
Yeah.
Project offices.
Throw them out.
That's amazing.
Impressive distance.
He is also a... project officer.
An office projector. I'm actually an OHP, I just got a torch and anything you need to be shown.
Office projector. He is also an office projector at the Museum of London Archaeology.
Project officer, God bless
you. Jesus Christ.
Should we start this entire episode again?
Just start the introduction again, I'll try and get it right this time.
Go see your archaeologist, it's perfectly fine.
It's fine. Our guest this week has been described. Nope.
Given by now you've heard quite a lot of false starts, here's a chat about the false start rule from our episode with Johnny Singer.
Do you know what the current false start rule is?
It's pretty much one strike and you're out.
It's one strike and you're out. Yeah, up to 2003, if you false started, you'd get a warning. And if someone else false started, then they'd get a warning. Someone else false started and you got a warning. Then the first person false started again, then they were disqualified. So everyone got a second chance the whole way through. And that and led to some races taking 7 or 8 times to get out of the blocks. Between 2003 and 2009, they had a one warning for the whole field rule. So if one person false started, then everyone else was on a warning and they got to restart as well.
I love that. That's the primary school teacher rule, isn't it?
That's, that went really wrong, didn't it? Because people would deliberately full start so that everyone was on a warning, so that everyone was now in the current situation of like... Because then if you've got someone who's a really fast starter, you take away their advantage because they can't go off too quickly.
Cunning. Yeah.
So now it's just one strike and you're out.
Now you've been so good and you've waited so patiently, here is a story from Angela Barnes about the time she appeared on Celebrity Deal or No Deal. Apologies for the poor sound quality, it was an early episode, but hopefully the story still makes you laugh as much as it does us.
I've done Deal or No Deal.
Yeah, I've done Walnut for one of the shows, so I've been on the set.
I mean, they do the celebrity one, and Alan Carr was doing it. And because I've supported Alan Carr, I was one of his box openers, as it were. I'm a box opener for Alan Carr. And we thought it was going to be a really fun day out. So a load of us were doing it. There was Susie Ruffle was there, and some of Alan's friends, and he was doing it for a cancer charity. So there was people from the charity who were on the boxer. His red setter, which one was it? Was it Joyce or the other one? No, it was Joyce, I think, was one of the box openers. Bev, no, it was Bev, the older one, Bev.
Oh, yeah.
Joyce is
underage.
Joyce is too young. And then to get her to stand by the box, we just filled it with quiche. So we were like, you have to get Bev to open the box first because the studio lights don't know in here for too long.
This box contains £1,000 and some keys.
So Bev was just dribbling on it. It got to open it, it was brilliant. You've worked on the show that it's mental. So have you read the John Ronson thing?
No.
John Ronson's written about Deal or No Deal. It's in one of his collections of articles and essays. Google it. I think it's online as well. It's brilliant. Because the people on it, it's like a cult.
Always reminds me a bit like the Branch Davidians got the wrong TV show.
With David Koresh. They're in this hotel, right? And they just put all this pressure on them to, you know... And it's a lottery. That's all it is. Yeah. But they're made to feel like there's some kind of... Well, he's into all this cosmic...
He's into his numerology and shit like that, yeah.
So anyway, we were on the way down there, we were all kind of taking a piss out of that sort of thing, going, oh, they get so into it. It's so much. When you get there, you sort of get taken into this green room. And the first thing they do is I'm going to teach you how to open the box. And I'm like, sorry, what? And then there's no, there's this way to do it. You know, you put your arm on top of the box and there's this catch and you're like, okay. But from there off, you're getting swept into this level of importance about this box that just isn't there, right? But you totally get... By the time you're in the studio, they have ramped up the tension in that green room so much that you're just like, we've got to win the jackpot. and I can't explain... Because the other thing is, when you do the celebrity one, the normal one, is obviously, you're rooting for the person because it'd be nice for them to have the money, but they don't, they're playing a game, it's fine. It's your charity when you're doing So when the 200, you open a box, he's got 250 grand in and he's not getting it.
Yeah.
You're like, we failed. We failed cancer.
Who had the 250,000 box?
I can't remember who had it, but actually what it came down to, it was horrible in the end. It was, because you have one person left and then Alan's box, and you get to choose whether to swap it or not.
Yeah.
And he didn't swap it. And I think Alan had the, or didn't, whichever way, it was if he'd done the other thing, he would have got 250.
Oh,
but, I mean, he still raised 70 grand or something. It was still got, a good amount of money. But you're just Alan cried. It was really stressful. I can't, it sounds mental.
No, but there's you go to a room and weird things happen.
So stressful.
Did they dress the audience all in black? Is that just me imagining it?
I didn't notice that they were all in black.
But every time, it's years since I've watched Deal or No Deal, but I sort of vaguely remember that every time you go up in the audience, it seemed like everyone was dressed in black trousers and black tops. They've been all told to dress appropriately for this cult that they've joined.
Very possibly. It's
Noel is the only one who can wear colour.
Obviously, our friend Mark Olver does most of the warm-ups for Deal or No Deal. And he said there were people who had been to Essendon recording. Just like, that's thousands and
thousands and thousands. And the weirdest thing is when he, so I briefly met Noel, which was very bizarre. And you go up there, and Noel's dressing room is up in the highest corner of the studio. And it's like going to meet some sort of cult leader playboy. And the whole rest of the studio is just sort of like a working studio. It's just got that sort of like very bare
back feel. That's the weird thing about that. It's in Bristol. I mean, they've moved it now, but it was in Bristol when we did it. And it's just like out in this industrial sort of, you get taken out there on a bus out into this field. It's a very strange experience,
really. Yeah.
What was the dressing room like? Full of floral shirts.
Full of mannequins, I reckon.
Well, full of mannequins with his face on. There was a waxwork from a lady just on Noel Edmonds.
Do you think Noel Edmonds has escaped waxwork?
Oh my god. He's meant to be Voltaire.
I mean, there is a picture in an attic somewhere, right? Because he does not look any different than he did in 1980.
No, he doesn't. I will say this for Noel Edmonds, having briefly met him. Two things. Very, very small. Smells pretty fragrant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it smells a lot nicer than you'd expect.
Wow. That's to cover up the reptile smell. No. Sorry, we've got a bit Ike then, it was a deeply odd experience. And afterwards, we, like everyone who was on it, and Alec, we all went for a meal. We were a bit shell-shocked. It was weird. We went for this meal in Bristol, and then those of us that were going back to London got on the train, and Alan was on the train as well with the two dogs. And he came and sat with us in standard class, right? Because we were like, we just wanted to get pizza. So Alan went to the buffet car, and he bought all the wine that they had and brought it back. And it was about, because it was recorded in the afternoon, so this was about 6 o'clock on a Monday evening. So the other people on the train were just people going home from work. Just to go from Bristol to London, so we went through like Bath and Swindon and places like that. And these people were getting on the train and just like, Is that a car? And Alan was just going around giving them champagne. On the way home, there was this kid on the carriage. We were hammered. There was this kid on the carriage, and I remember he had like a what obviously was a musical instrument, and then got, and Alan was like, "Oh, what you got in there?" So, oh, clarinet. Like, he must have been about 16, 17, this kid.
Yeah.
Really nerdy looking kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, give us a tune.
Did he make him open the boxes?
Showed him how to do it.
Yeah.
This kid got his clarinet out and was playing the tune. Oh. And I was just thinking, this kid is going to go home and no one is going to believe him.
Christopher Lee died the same day as Ron Moody, didn't he?
What is Fagin?
Yeah.
Oh, so they died on the same day.
Fagin and Saruman up in heaven jamming together.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Princess Diana kind of blotting out Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa, yeah.
JFK blowing out Aldous Huxley.
And C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, they were the same day as well.
Fun fact. CIA got all three of them. Fucking hat trick.
The very first episode of Doctor Who ever was the day after JFK was assassinated. So JFK's 22nd of November 63. An Unearthly Child episode one, Cave of Skulls, was broadcast on the 23rd. And then because pretty much no one watched it, they repeated it the next week.
Well, I thought you were going to suggest that JFK was the original Doctor Who. And then he regenerated into William Hart. That feels like it fits with canon.
Yeah, yes, totally. We could retcon that.
Yeah, definitely.
What a way to, I mean, that's an idea for Chris Chibnall, if he's listening, for Jodie Whittaker's out as she gets assassinated in the car in Dallas.
Yeah, I fucking need some ideas.
Ooh. Ben does not like the new Doctor Who series, listeners.
Ben really wants to like the new Doctor Who series, but he does not like it.
Maybe we'll edit this bit out, because I feel we might shed hundreds of listeners.
Fuck yes. Anyway, to business.
Let's just defile some religions instead.
Yeah. Yeah, no one will get upset about that. Yeah.
Our ratings have gone through the roof.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I interject here?
Please do.
With a hinge and bracket anecdote?
There aren't enough of them around.
Now, my band cultivated two fans, middle-aged women, sort of late 30s, early 40s. who both dressed in a very kind of burlesque sort of loads of makeup, kind of wigs and fur and feathers and all this sort of thing. And we began to, and our drummer Jez coined the term hinge and bracket for them. And this was...
For our American listeners, they're a comedy double act.
They were sort of drag comedy, a kind of classic cross-dress comedy double act.
Yeah.
And then, so I became good friends with one of them, and I won't name her. And you know, we saw each other on and off, and a little bit of flirtation, and blah blah blah, and
some bracketing.
And I didn't see her enough, but you know, and I did a gig near where she lived, and we were sat outside. It's like a sort of festival gig. We were sat outside. And she said, I'm going through some really hard times. She split up with her husband. I'm going through some very, nothing to do with me. Going through some really hard times. And you know, I said, well, look, you know, like, let's try and make sure we see each other at least, you know, a couple of times a year, blah, blah, blah. Right, that's fine, no problem. So she said, you got my number? I'm like, yeah, I got my number. So I put her name into my phone and I'm kind of saying, why don't I have your number? Maybe it was my offer, I don't know, I should have it. Why don't I have it? That's weird, isn't it? That's weird. She goes, okay, well, let me put my number in your phone. She types her number into my phone and it comes up Hinge.
Oh no.
I had forgotten. Yeah. And she went, why have you got me under Hinge? And my brain went, sorry, mate, you're on your own. And I just went, well. And had to just front it. And happily, I had, I think, flirted with her enough that she kind of appreciated that it was actually more to do with the other one, but also it was... And no effect, but I've never felt more bad about my talking behind someone's back.
That's worse than the sending a text, sending the text to the person the text is about, because you've given them your actual phone.
She had my phone and was typing her number in and it came up. Why has this come up? Hinge. That's my number. Oh, God, there's no way around this. So yeah, Megan's you know, worships the Morrigan, and my patron deity is Mercury, the god of stand-up comedy, as I'll talk about in a bit. And when we've done rituals together, Megan's had to go away and placate the Morrigan because I'm there and I have my own god. Mm. So she has to put a shitload of work in to stop the Morrigan preventing our ritual from working, because
of that sovereignty,
so high maintenance, absolutely. And she's been over to Ireland to kind of like to camp in battle sites and stuff, and she has dreams about battles. She's way better at this stuff than I am, and has a, you know, much more kind of in touch. But it's really that territorial thing is really, really interesting.
Yeah, it really is. Well, because the thing is, that's what I really like about all the various different pantheons, is that they are, it just makes so much more sense for human psychology that there are bunch of different gods. They're all quite territorial. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Abrahamic god is very, very territorial, but there's no give or take.
Yeah,
with the Abrahamic God. The Abrahamic God is basically the current British government, and the rest of the gods are the EU.
Yeah,
and
that's true. Yeah,
but after
trying to get, you know, Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, he gave up all of the playing tricks on people, which the other gods kept. Which I quite like the trickery stuff.
Well, delicious vegan.
We're having to sacrifice some free from brownies to the Morrigan during this podcast.
So, she's very much appreciated. It's interesting the way, because most of the pantheon gods, they don't make a claim to have created you. They're just a part of nature. Whereas when you get to monotheism, you have to explain all this disparate stuff. Not only am I didn't I create you? I'm also responsible for the bad things that happen to you, but you need to worship me as though I'm mainly responsible for the good stuff. So let's invent the devil, who is, you know, originally kind of like, not actually like God's enemy, he's kind of actually God's ally, and then, but no, because we need to present God as good,
Whereas, obviously, you know, in pagan religions, the gods aren't good. They don't give a shit about you. Yeah. And, oh, so he's benevolent. So we need to create now, make turn the devil into the god's enemy. But if God's omnipotent, he could defeat him. Ah, oh, but nah. Ah. See,
saying God has a plan really doesn't work in the way that, no, we're just bystanders in a massive game of chess between the gods.
Yeah, God does have a plan, but his plan looks like one of those cork boards of someone trying to solve a murder with lots of red string going all over it.
But also, my friend of mine, who's a PhD Bible scholar, reads Greek, ancient Greek, Aramaic, and like is an actual genius. And she's also she calls herself a Christian. I wouldn't necessarily, because I was like, right, okay,
let's have this out.
Right, the resurrection. Do you genuinely believe he died and came back? She went, well, I mean, died, you know, died for then is not the same as died now. I'm like, right, no, you know, I'm not having it. Anyway, so but the thing, and what she's taught me, because I used to be one of those like dickhead annoying atheists.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the Bible contradicts itself. Yeah, duh. And she's very like her take on it, and the actual theological take on it. So the people who were in the know, not idiots on the internet who God has a plan for you, and, you know, they basically say all this earthly stuff, God's got nothing to do with any of that.
Yeah.
It's and Christianity is all about elevating your spiritual self for when, like, not necessarily for when you die, but the part of you, and this, you know, in Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah is a very similar thing. All this, you know, like with the Kabbalah, Malkut, the sphere at the very bottom, that's Earth, and everything, all the more important stuff is way up. So is that kind of Dawkinsite kind of pointing out the flaws in Christianity, and any decent Bible scholar goes, sit down and I'll tell you all the ones you've missed.
Yeah.
They're absolutely on it. It's really interesting.
Funnily enough, I was chatting to a mate yesterday about DMT, something that she has taken, but I have not. And DMT, as far as I understand it, is the chemical that is released in your brain when you're born and when you die. Mm-hmm. And there are so many experiences people have where they say they've smoked it, and the beings that they have met when they hallucinate, everyone's description of them is extraordinarily similar, and the things that they see. And again, these are people on...
And you're in a domed... there's a domed roof to it, and...
Yeah.
And the thing is, my last ritual experience, which I haven't really unpacked yet, I, for the first time, I felt like I was contacted by a consciousness that didn't have anything like an anthropomorphized form.
Yeah.
So all these gods we're talking about, all these gods we're going to talk about, they feel like human stories. And this is when I rejected Christianity. I was like, this feels too much like a human story as an explanation for the infinite complexity of the universe.
Mm.
This felt totally alien, totally, like, not, like, a bit scary, but, like, it was properly a much higher level of consciousness and a much higher level of existence that isn't, and again, with Kabbalistic terms, which is my framework for it, it hasn't kind of pulled down into this kind of physical, human recognised... Yeah, if God exists, we wouldn't recognise him.
Yeah.
He wouldn't go... It's, you know, it, and that was the first time it felt like this wasn't channeled through a story that was there in order for me to be able to understand it. Mm. Now, I haven't explored enough to know whether these different levels of consciousness, these different levels are existing separate from each other, whether Quaver exists as his own being. I don't really know, and I'm reticent to offer my own hard explanations for him.
Well, that's the thing, like, to how existent does something have to be for it to exist, in a sense. If you're conjuring these things up in your mind, do they that you could debate how real they are, depending on how far willing you're
and
to
how
go
important
into them.
Is it that it's real?
Yeah.
So, you know, Alan Moore always talks about the idea of a chair is far more important than a physical chair, because if you destroy all physical chairs, the idea of the chair persists, and you can then create chairs.
Mm.
And this is where I don't wield, you know, I believe this, therefore we should have capital punishment.
Yeah.
That's where it starts to get into, talking politically, this consciousness that I contacted a couple of weeks ago, did the one thing it did say to me. There was an image of Trump, and it went, I raised the fucking pyramids for this. And it was like, and it's this notion that I'd never previously believed, that humanity over the years has been contacted by higher levels of beings. And this started to push me down an InfoWars alien conspiracy thing. I'm not entirely comfortable with, but this is what happened.
And it was just this really funny idea of, like, to think I've been helping you guys out over the years, and you're now supposed to be the high point of civilization. This is the end point so far, and you're doing this. It was really
telling off from the head of department at school, isn't it?
It's playing Sid Meier's Civilization, and on your tech pyramid, you've suddenly turned over a trump card, and you go, "Oh, you lose all of your existing technology." Back down to the bottom.
Oh, I'm a snake.
I've managed to break down a rabbi in argument to basically admitting that some of the more obscure rules, some of the kosher rules, are basically because God says so rules.
Yeah, right.
They are do it to prove that you believe in me.
Right.
Which is reasonably honest of him.
Well, look, again, according to Alan Moore, the homophobia in the Bible is due to, Christianity and Judaism do this a lot, because there were so many competing religions and sects. It was to divide themselves against a sect that practiced ritual homosexuality. So they're like, don't be gay, because that lot does the gay, and we don't do the gay. Yeah. And that's why.
And actually, the Zachi Pili, who I mentioned earlier, the god of gay prostitutes, there's some debate as to whether actually he was a god of homosexuals, which there were a lot of in ancient religions, and it was fairly well accepted to be homosexual. But and then the Spanish arrived and went, "Oh, he's the god of gay fuck boys. That's who he is."
Yeah, right.
Then with the Christian beliefs and sort of mocking the local cultures.
There was a big thing I read recently about how, so India has just either decriminalised or legalised homosexuality, the article said that actually all of the taboos against it were brought over by the British Empire.
Yep.
Actually, pre-Empire, India was... What a surprise. The country of the Kama Sutra was pretty cool with homosexuality.
Yeah, early communist Russia were quite cool with the gays for a bit, until Stalin got in and got a bit paranoid about anybody who had any difference to the party line.
And with that moustache, I mean, come on.
Yeah. A clear bear.
Come on, daddy.
Yeah, you know, Stalin means poking the man Russian of steel. Yeah.
poking the Russian bear has a very different conversation.
Or there's the Dutch fleet, who got stuck at Den Helder off the coast of the Netherlands in the frozen waters in 1795 and were captured by French horsemen who trotted out across the ice. Right? Thus suffering the ignominious honour of being the only naval fleet in history to be defeated by a cavalry charge. You may insert your own jokes about seahorses here.
And speaking of horses, there's Zippy Chippy, the thoroughbred racehorse who became famous in America for racing 100 times without victory. He even, in the year 2000, raced against a minor league baseball player and lost. In the same year, People magazine declared Zippy Chippy one of the world's most interesting personalities, which I think is a major blow for people everywhere.
The saddest thing for the horse, of course, is that they did the race in a baseball diamond, so as well as losing, he was also caught out by one of the pitchers as well.
Can I ask a quick question?
You can.
So we have a bag full of your children's toys.
Yes.
What do they do with the ricer?
Make rice, duh.
Wow, you have very advanced children, can I just say? / child labour issues, need to call someone.
Okay, Rhea up next. This is British Enfant Terrible Sarah Kane's play Cleansed. Rhea is frantically...
I'm not finding what I need. I want what's one of them?
Oh, a slide whistle.
Yeah,
a slide
whistle.
I mean,
what's the closest thing you got here?
The closest thing I've got is the rubber chicken down there.
Yeah,
that's my rubber chicken.
Thank you. Sorry, give me one moment to just test my... Yeah, that's really like a slide whistle, isn't it?
Now, do you want the stage direction read along with you again, or would you like us to remind the audience of it and then you can...
That's not working. Hang on. Are your children deaf? What is this? You just don't want your children making any noise, do you?
I appreciate...
Rice your potatoes in quiet, kids!
I appreciate the picture of my domestic life that these pieces of evidence display is rather disturbing.
What is your child learning from this toy?
How to torture hedgehogs.
Right, oh, God. Okay, all right, fine.